Just out of curiosity, how many were not here last night? Okay. You leave too. No. I'll do a reminder of what I covered last night very briefly on the relativism issue to get this session rolling. So we're not rolling yet tape-wise, but I'm still waiting for people to come in. And got some more seats.
Thank you for being nice.
You're welcome. Good. I'll mention that here. You got the jump on everybody else. That was smart. There's an empty seat up here. There's also, is this an empty seat here?
No, this one's taken.
This one's taken. Is there an empty seat? Okay, if you have an empty seat next to you, would you please hold your hand up? And here, there are more chairs coming in. There's a couple seats over here. Just move towards a raised hand. If you're like really young with more flexible limbs than us old folk, you might want to sit on the floor and let an old timer have your seat, although we have some more coming in. Those of you who have schedules, this session is supposed to end when? Theoretically. 10 o'clock? 11 o'clock? Yeah, it's a 50-minute segment. We're starting 25 minutes late, so all right. Everything's pushed back, I guess. Again, before we get started, just one note, and some of you already know about this because you've been by our table. People have said that I speak a little quickly. One person said I speak at 180 miles an hour with gusts up to 200. So it's hard to take notes. And what we've done is made my lecture notes available to you. Now, these are like 4 or 5 years old, which means, you know, people make changes. I make changes in my talks. And so there are going to be things in these notes that aren't in what I have to say today. And there's going to be things that I say today aren't quite in here. But this is very comprehensive by and large. 19 pages. These are what I lecture from. Okay? $3. It's a bargain. We have maybe 50 copies on our table. So after we're done here, if you haven't already got yours, like this bright young woman here, purchased hers already so she can follow along. Where it says laugh in the margin, that's a joke. But the rest of you can grab these if you like later. I'd encourage you to still take notes because it helps you remember, even if you go back to what I write down. But this will be available. And if you run out, I have this one with me. I usually forget this. I put it in my folder, and then we run out, and I've got one left. So if you're looking for one and can't find it, remember I have one with me. Well, thank you for coming this morning. Are you all awake?
Yeah.
You know, I learned a long time ago I was not a morning person. One woman said, Mr. Kolkle, you must have a great quiet time in the morning. I said, frankly, man, before my first cup of coffee, I'm an atheist, you know. My mornings are very quiet. But I've got my coffee already. I had my little Starbucks from across the street, and now it's like getting in my bloodstream. And so actually right now I'm a Jehovah's Witness. You know, give me another hour, I'll be full-fledged biblical theist. We want to talk this morning in kind of a workshop fashion. That is, it's a little bit less formal than the plenary session yesterday, about a topic that I identified yesterday as one of the most critical for us as Christians to be able to understand in order to have an impact as an ambassador for Christ. Paul said in Colossians that we are not to be taken captive by philosophy and empty deception, which are according to the traditions of men instead of according to Christ, Colossians 2:9. He also said in 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians chapter 10, that we are not only to be on the defensive, Colossians, but we are to take the offensive, that is tearing down speculations and lofty things, ideas, speculations raised up against the knowledge of God, and take every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. Now, these two exhortations are very strong, challenges to us to be engaged at some level in the world of ideas if we are thinking about making an impact in that world for the cause of Christ. One is a defensive posture so that we keep from being taken in by the false philosophies. The other is a further step of being able to understand them enough to go a bit on the offensive and try to tear those kinds of things down. And while I want to give you some tools this morning that will help you to do that, I think the most pressing issue of the time is relativism. I'll define that for you in just a moment for those that missed last evening. It is the air 21st century people breathe nowadays. And this is especially true if you're under 20, which I see a lot of younger faces here. And please don't take umbrage at my comment yesterday about not liking to talk to young people. I didn't mean you. I meant those other young people. See? But this is the air you breathe. This is the environment that you live in. It is presumed that things like morality and values and ethics and religious convictions, faith, are just a matter of individual preference. There are no truths to these issues. They are what you believe, and everybody's belief is as equal as anybody else's. Now, I'm going to explain in a minute, at least when it comes to morality, that even though this is our posture and our knee-jerk reaction in our culture, the way we talk, it turns out deep down inside, we know very differently. And you know from the illustration I gave about my lecture at Berkeley a couple years ago, I gave the illustration last night, that there's a way that if we understand this, that people have a deep understanding of morality, so much so that they're aware of their own guilt, that this is something we can draw on to make our point about forgiveness available through Christ. And I was able to do that at Berkeley. In fact, I try, in every non-Christian audience that I address, I try to make the point that I made and I talked to you about last night. And I will tell you, I've spoken on 40 university campuses, not all non-Christian, many Christian, but many non-Christian. And I have never a single time had anyone come up to me and tell me that they did not experience guilt, the feelings of guilt, and they did not have a bad self-image. And if anybody told me they didn't feel guilty, I would tell them, I don't believe you. Unless there's something wrong with them. Like, sociopaths don't feel guilt, but that's not a good thing to be. All right? Now, as Christians, and I could talk for a long time on this, and I'm not going to address it now specifically, but there are many ways in which relativism has influenced the church. So Paul's admonition in Colossians for us to be on guard is very, very important. Because this subtly comes in to our church culture and influences our Christianity in ways that we don't completely understand or realize. And I've spoken on this in the past, and of course, Christians always want to find, relativism, not a bad thing. Where is it in the church? Let's get it. And then all of a sudden, their ox gets gored, you know, and then they're not so happy, you know. It's fun until somebody gets their eye poked out, and it's, you know, and then they're mad at me. In other words, I start stepping on their toes, and they realize that they themselves have been influenced by relativism. But suffice it to say that we need to have a basic foundational understanding. So let me to redefine what I mean by relativism. I used an illustration last night as kind of a springboard, a phrase or a word, two words actually, when I described what relativism regarding morality was like. What was the words that I used?
Ice cream.
You know, when you choose your flavors of ice cream, you know, you choose what you like. I'm going to talk more about this in my last session. Group session today in the issue on truth is not ice cream and faith is not wishing. But the simple idea is we understand that that's okay. Everybody has their own flavors and there's no right or wrong about that, okay? But when it comes to choosing medicines like insulin, was the illustration I used, well, you choose not what you like, but what's real, what's true. And you don't make it up as you go along. It's not just a matter of flavor. You got to get the right answer on that one. And so this is the difference between a subjective truth and an objective truth. Subjective is true for the person, the subject. Objective truth is true for the thing, regardless of what the subject, the individual, happens to believe about it. Now, again, I'll go in more detail about that later this afternoon, but let me give you a little bit more technical way of putting it. When we make a claim that torture is wrong, and we're claiming that this is a true statement. The question is, what makes the statement true? Now, as an objectivist, as a Christian, I believe in objective moral truths, okay? As an objectivist, I think that what makes this statement true is something about torture. Right? In other words, something about the object, if I can use that term. And here I'm not using the word object as if it were a physical thing. I'm using it as if something that's external to me, something out there. So this activity, this statement, torture is wrong, is a true statement if it is the case that this activity is wrong. So the truth maker is some fact in the world, in the objective world. The thing that makes this statement true, some feature in this external world. Now, I see some like deer in the headlights there, which is okay. If you got the ice cream insulin thing, that's plenty good enough. Okay, this is more graduate level. If you get this, you're another step up in understanding. But if you miss this, no problems. Because in a minute, I'm going to actually give a case against relativism, but I want you to get this issue clearly in your sights. This is an insulin thing. Remember, I was talking with the old terminology, okay? The thing that makes torture wrong is the fact that torture itself is wrong. If it is, then my statement is true. That's objectivism. Okay, remember, objectivism, good. Relativism, bad. Okay, so now I'm going to tell you relativism. In the case of relativism, if a relativist says torture is wrong, I as an objectivist say torture is wrong, and it's true if and only if torture itself is a moral harm, okay? But if I were a relativist, this statement would be true. I could say, yeah, that's true, but what makes it true? As a relativist, it is nothing about torture that makes it true. It is nothing about the object that makes it true. It's rather the thing that makes this true is that I think it's true. I as a subject. In other words, the truth is relative to the subject. Therefore, if I think torture is wrong, then it's true. What comes next? For me. If you think torture is okay, then it's not true for you. But on this view, those contrary viewpoints are not actually in conflict because you have two different people have different points of view, and it's just like flavors in ice cream. You like chocolate, I like vanilla. No conflict there. Now, of course, this idea that things are true if and only if the subject believes it, it is true relative to the subject. That's why we call it relativism. It's also known as a kind of subjectivism. It's up to the individual. This is reflected in the book of Judges by the phrase, every man did what was right in his own eyes. Okay? I think when it comes to morality, this is not an accurate way of understanding morality. I think this is the accurate way of understanding morality. In fact, the whole biblical worldview is grounded in this notion. And if relativism is actually true, that is, if it's a fact that there are no objective moral principles and there are just different points of view, different flavors that people like, and that's the end of it, then Christianity is a goner. It's done for. Christianity cannot get started if relativism is true, because Christianity depends on the fact that Jesus is the Savior and He saves us from sin, and sin is a violation of one of these kinds of things. Objective moral harms, not a violation of relativistic notions. Therefore, if relativism is true, objectivism is false, then there are no objective moral principles to violate in order to be guilty of sin. And if you're not guilty of sin, you don't need a Savior. If you don't need a Savior, you don't need Jesus. Do you see how Christianity now is irrelevant on this view? And by the way, can you see why people are apathetic about Christianity if they're convinced that relativism is true? They haven't put the whole equation together like I just did for you, but that's what's going on. What's the point? If Jesus just turns out to be ice cream, well, there's lots of flavors out there. What are you guys getting all hot and bothered about your flavor for? Do you see? That makes sense to them. Because they misunderstood. And a lot of Christians misunderstand too. By the way, just for your information, if you want to get depressed, remember I talked about defending against these views. Paul says in Colossians 2, I think it's 2:9 and following. According to George Barna, among those who identify themselves as what he labels born-again Christians, but they say they have a relationship with Jesus, that relationship believing in Jesus is meaningful to them on a day-to-day basis, and it's that relationship and forgiveness of sins with Jesus that gets them into heaven. Okay, that sounds like our kind of people, right? Born-again Christians. Two-thirds of adult born-again Christians in America believe in this. You want to really get depressed? If your youth group is like the average youth group in a church in this country, and I know your youth group is not average, and I say that to every youth group, then you will not find 1 in 10 young people in your church who claim to be born again Christians who affirms objective morality. Not 1 in 10 here. 91.5% are relativists. You think relativism has taken over the church? Absolutely. Now, what I'd like to do is, now we kind of got this in view here, kind of got a definition, right? Okay, what I want to do is give an argument against this. Since I think this is false, it's incumbent upon me to give reasons why I think it's false. So I'm going to give you an actual argument against this. And there are actually a couple of different forms that you're going to encounter. And I'm just going to write one more word up here just as a reminder that relativism is a view that a thing is true if the subject says it's true. Okay? Now, this actually has three main forms. And I'm going to give you some thoughts on each one because if you traffic in this idea, you're going to encounter all three forms. Especially if you're in university, you'll encounter the first form. Okay? The first form of relativism is what I call society does relativism. Okay? Now, this is what you encounter in anthropology classes a lot. Okay? And here's the way the argument goes. In fact, my very first debate on this was with a PhD over at California State University in Northridge. Her name was Dr. Magliocco. She spoke 5 languages. She had a PhD, obviously, in anthropology. She was brilliant. And when she started her portion of the debate, this is the way she argued, and it is the standard way that people have argued with me, PhDs, from podiums like this in debates to large audiences, to defend relativism. So what I want to show you here is this is one way that people have defended that relativism, things are true for subjects, that's the way to view morality, that this is the accurate way to understand the moral project in the world, that people aren't following moral rules because there are objective moral rules, but they're following them. They think there are objective moral rules when they're not. And here's the argument they offer. Society does relativism. It's really an observation. The observation is this. Look at, Dr. Magliocco made the same point. Different cultures have different moral points of view. And many of you have traveled abroad. You've seen something like this. I lived in Thailand for 7 months working in a Cambodian refugee camp. And in 1982, and I've been to other places as well, and you notice differences. You can't avoid this. Not only that, she said, but in one culture, from one period of time to another, there are different points of view. At a given time in a culture, there are different points of view. In other words, everybody's got a different point of view. Therefore, she argued, morals are relative to a subject, and in this case, the subject is what?
Society.
Now, notice that this is an observation only about what societies do. That's why I call it society does relativism. For some reason, people think this is a very powerful argument in favor of moral relativism. But I want to make an observation. Even if I granted that all this wide diversity actually existed. And I'm going to take exception with that in a moment, but let's just grant that their observation is an accurate one. What follows, and this is a kind of a technical phrase I'm using now, because what I want you to think is, I want you to think about an evidence that is offered and a conclusion that is drawn from the evidence. Okay? So when I say what follows, what I'm asking is, what conclusion can you properly get from the evidence that's offered? Okay? I think there's a logical problem in this, that they've gotten to a conclusion illicitly. They've concluded something the evidence doesn't show if we think about it. So here's my question. What follows about morality from the observation that people have different points of view about what's right and what's wrong? What can one conclude about morality by the fact that people have different opinions about what is right and what is wrong? Now, while you're thinking about this, let me put it a little more easy. I'll put it in a different phrase, a different way. There was a time when some people thought that the earth was flat and some people thought that the earth was round. People had different points of view, right? So now we observe in this culture that there's a debate going on. This guy thinks it's round and this guy thinks it's flat. What does the fact of difference of opinion tell us about the shape of the earth? It doesn't tell us anything about the shape of the earth. It doesn't even tell us that there is an earth. And this is a very important point. You cannot get from the fact of disagreement on anything to a conclusion that nobody's right. You can't get there from here. It's called a non sequitur. It doesn't follow that if two people or three people or four people or 15 people all have different ideas about the right answer to a problem, that therefore there is no right answer and that all of the answers are equally right to the individual who holds them. There's a logical error in this. This woman speaks five languages, has at least one PhD. She's brilliant, as were many of the people who I debated against, but they made a fundamental error in thinking. You can't get there from here. This is not an observation about morality. It's an observation about what? Societies. Which it's not surprising then that it was an anthropologist who made the point. Now, when you go to university and get into an anthropology class, you're going to get this hammered on your head, young people. You're going to go to a class and you're going to say, look, these guys believed in this, and these guys believe in this, these guys believe in this. So how can you say that morals are objective or absolute in some sense? And my question is, Professor, how can you say otherwise? Can you please, notice I'm asking a question to the professor here. I'm not taking him on in a power struggle. I'm just saying, can you explain to me how it follows that if three people disagree about the answer that nobody's right? That would be interesting to apply to the final exam, wouldn't it? There are no right answers on the final exam. You know why? Because the teacher and I disagree. I think one, he thinks right. He thinks he's right. How arrogant. There are a whole bunch of people in this room that didn't agree with him, and he thinks he's right. You see how you laugh? Because it's a silly thing. It's the exact same thing that's going on here. So I don't agree that the observation follows, even if they've got their underlying facts correct, that underlying facts being that societies do differ. It turns out that this isn't even a sound observation, because there's a distinction here between underlying facts and the values underlying values and the facts that pertain to them. For example, some people think there's a wide diversity of opinion with regards to the basic values in abortion in this country. But largely, both sides, pro-life or pro-abortion, have the same underlying point of view, same value. However, they disagree about facts pertaining to the issue. They both agree that it's, largely speaking, there are exceptions to this, but that it's wrong to take the life of innocent human persons. We both agree on that. The question is not an ethical question about whether it's right or wrong to take the life of innocent human persons. It's rather a factual difference as to whether the unborn is an example of an innocent human person or not. So you can see there where it appears there's a diversity, there really isn't any diversity. And almost all of the distinctions between all cultures and times can be explained in that way. When you get away from the factual distinctions, it turns out that there is a core of things that seem to be foundational. C.S. Lewis gives a list of these in the appendix of his book, The Abolition of Man, for example. But, you know, just reflecting on morality and laws that are consistent with all societies, you can see that there's something else that's driving this, all right? So there does seem to be some consistency that's suggestive. But I'm not going to make my argument on that consistency. I'm just using it to show that this claim is false. Not only are there facts about the differences overplayed, but even if the facts were correct, you still can't get there from here. This really is not a statement about morality. It is a statement about anthropology. Okay. The next type of relativism. You with me on? Are we all together so far in this? More or less. Do you have any questions? Sorry, I can't answer them. We don't have time. The next one is different. It deals with society, but it's a legitimate moral thesis as opposed to an anthropological thesis. And I call this Society Says Relativism. Okay? Now, once again, the society is the subject. Society as a whole is the subject. And this view basically says we have an obligation to do what our society tells us to do. This kind of is expressed in different ways, there's a social contract kind of sense of this. Rousseau mentioned this. Hobbes, the philosopher, the 19th century philosopher, said that life in an unregulated state of nature, okay, life in the wild, is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. He put it so well. Therefore, since we realize how tough it is to live out there without society, we have kind of agreed to live in a social structure that follows a certain set of rules, and this helps us all survive. So there's your social contract mentality. Sometimes when people say that morality has evolved, this is what they have in mind, that it evolved culturally, not in terms of Darwinian methodology, but they may mean that, but that's a different thing. Oftentimes they will say, well, we have this evolving social contract, okay? So this is this view. Because we kind of have an implicit social contract, we are morally obligated to obey, to follow the rules that we all agree on so that we can live in a healthy society. Now, this is very compelling. This seems to cover a lot of ground for many people who want to reject objective morality, moral rules kind of written up in the universe somewhere that are separate from culture. They want to say, no, there's none of that kind of stuff because that's getting too close to God stuff, you know. So here's how we can explain it. We can explain it this way. This is a social contract. And then we all live harmoniously together. Okay, now that's compelling, but there are some problems with it. I think that even though it sounds appealing, on closer inspection, this turns out to be an inadequate understanding of morality, and we know better when we think about it. Notice my methodology here. I'm not putting anything in a test tube, not weighing anything. I'm not looking at doing chemical analysis. We are doing a process of mere reflection. And we realize here, given this point of view, once we get this point of view clearly in our sights, we just think about it. We say, does that really work? No, that doesn't work when you think about it. A lot of people don't think about it. That's why it works for them. I'm not trying to be glib. It's just the fact of the matter. Here's another one that is a little bit more subtle and therefore works better for people. But, you know, when we think about it, it seems to produce some, might I say, counterintuitive results. That is, wait, that just doesn't seem right. What do I mean by that? If this is the right way of viewing morality, then what is it that defines right versus wrong? Who decides that?
Society
decides that, okay? Society says what's right and wrong. And we have an obligation to obey what society says so that we all live in harmony. Now, let me just make, this is a graduate level observation, so some of you won't get this, but that's okay. but for some of you may catch this. Notice that when somebody says, we have an obligation to do what society says. Now, what kind of obligation do they have in mind there? Moral obligation. Okay. Right versus wrong is determined by the society, but we have a moral obligation. We ought to do what society says for us to do. Where did that obligation come from? Because society tells me I ought to obey them? Well, why ought I obey what society tells me I ought to obey? Do you notice that this system smuggles in a moral principle to make it work that isn't explained by this understanding of relativism? It smuggles in. Well, see, well, because if we don't live together, then people will die. Yes, innocent people will die. Yes, but that's not nice. Yes, but why should I care whether innocent people die? Why should I be nice to people? Do you see how they're assuming that I have a moral obligation to be nice and I should care about harmony and all those other things? You see, they have to assume a morality still on the outside of their system. And it's that morality that needs to be explained. So this smuggles in the kind of morality I believe in trying to explain away the kind of morality I believe in. By the way, all of this detail is in the book, and some of you bought the book, and I'm sorry we only could bring a handful, but you can get them at str.org, our website, or Amazon. Buy them from us. But if you can't, you can still get them at Amazon. Quick.
So in that argument, can you just flip around relativism back on them?
I'll talk about tactics probably towards the end, because we're going to do something like that, and you're on the right track. I just want you to see there's a smuggling in, and this happens all the time. People presume a morality, they smuggle it in, trying to explain morality. But let's look at this concept. If it is that society determines what's right or wrong, what does that equation amount to? It amounts to that society taken as a whole is always what?
Right.
Right. By definition. They're the ones who decide, right? So that means if you have two societies, and you're in society A, and society B is doing things that society A would never say, would never do on their morality, what can you say about what society B is doing? Nothing. You have no grounds to object to what society B is doing. So when you have apartheid in South Africa, how can we say, on this view now, I'm placing myself within this view and I'm asking myself, is this going to work? On this view, can I say that apartheid's wrong? All I can say is that apartheid is wrong for Americans. I can't say that it's wrong for South Africans. That's their business. They're on a different island, now a very big island of moral neutrality. Remember, I talked about that last night. So you have no grounds, no place to stand to make an objection against another group because there is no objective morality that governs both cultures. You with me? This is something people miss. They want to affirm this point of view, society says relativism, and then say apartheid's wrong, or what Hitler did was wrong. By the way, that was the defense of the Nazis during the Nuremberg trials. We only did what? What we were ordered to do. And that was the end of the moral question for them, which would be the case if society says relativism is true. Not only can you not reform from the outside a culture, morally, that seems odd, doesn't it? It does seem that there are some things that our cultures do that are just wrong, like what the Nazis did by pressing Jews into forced labor and executing them, taking their goods. And the International Court understood that. Now, it's increasingly difficult to get college kids, and this is why I'm saying that this has deeply influenced the younger generation, college kids, to affirm that the Nazis did actual wrong. You know what they say? And this is also true of what happened at 9/11. You know what they always say? Anybody want to tell me what they say when I say, isn't this obviously wrong? What do they say? Just give me one sentence. Do you know what they say? They say they thought they were doing right. The Nazis thought they were doing right. The Muslims thought they were doing right. Who am I to say they were wrong? Do you see how deeply influenced they are by relativism? Okay. Not only can you not reform from the outside, you can't reform from the inside. What happens when you have our society here and the majority rules that racism is good, which was the case for a long time, implicitly ruled that essentially, and then you have a moral reformer, a Martin Luther King and other men like him, that stood up in the midst of the majority as a majority of one. You can only be a majority of one if you have the right on your side. But on this view of relativism, society says relativism, guess what? You cannot be a majority of one because the right is defined by what the majority decides. Therefore, on this sphere, there cannot be, by definition, any immoral societies. There cannot be any moral reformers because the moral reformer is a minority in a society that is calling for change in the society because society at large is doing wrong and they ought to conform to a better moral standard. On this view, a moral reformer turns out to be what? Immoral. By definition. Now, doesn't it just seem, you think about it for a moment, that Martin Luther King and those like him were right, not because the masses were with them. They were right to be courageous and bold to ask for a change in behavior because that which they represented was true even when the majority disagreed. You see, this is the perfect democratic form of morality. But it seems pretty obvious that when it comes to morality, when we simply reflect on our inner sense and awareness of what morality entails, what moral obligations involve, it seems pretty obvious that the majority isn't always right. I have a radio show on weekends. I've been doing talk radio for 16 years now. In fact, you can go to our website at str.org. And not only can you download our show in MP3, but you can we podcast. So you can have the show delivered right to your door, as it were, through podcasting. It's all available at str.org. But I had an attorney, a woman attorney, called in once, and she was objecting about our stand on abortion. And she said, look it, abortion is legal. That was her argument. Now, of course, implied in that is it's legal, so you have nothing to say about it. As if legality exhausted the moral equation. Well, that's exactly what happens here with society says relativism. But that just seems to be wrong, doesn't it? I remember a former president who said, I didn't do anything illegal. Well, it was laughable, not to bring derision on any individual there, but that's a good example that you're familiar with. It's laughable because we know that legality and morality are not the same thing, but they are perilously close on this view. If it's legal, it's moral, because there's no higher appeal. All right. So not only a society does relativism seem to be insufficient, society says relativism, which is actually a bona fide moral thesis. In other words, it addresses the moral question rather than the anthropological question. That also seems to fall short. Okay, there's a third type of relativism. And the third type of relativism is, I characterize it as, I say relativism. And in that case, the subject who determines the truth of a moral claim is not a group, but an individual. By the way, this second kind, society says, this was, any Trekkers out here? Any more? Do they still exist? Trekker is a person who really liked Star Trek. You might know it as Trekkies, but Trekkie is the kind of the phony way of saying Trekker, because the insiders call themselves Trekkers. If you say Trekkie, then they know you're an outsider. Well, never mind. The prime directive was an example of society says relativism. In fact, if you go to the website, there's an article that I wrote that explains this concept more, and it's called Star Trek Morality. You can just write Star Trek in the search box and it'll come up. It's a freebie. That's the kind of stuff we have on the website. So if you want to review this concept, there it is. The third type, I say relativism, this is where the individual is the subject. Individual ethical relativism, it's also called, where it's up to the individual, if you will. By the way, some of you are familiar with the term postmodernism, which is kind of a radical relativism that's taken over our culture. Postmoderns are not individual relativists. They are more group relativists, just FYI, for those interested in that. They don't say anybody can do whatever they want. Rather, you have to obey the group. But they still fall in a relativistic framework. I say relativism is the idea that I make up my own moral rules. I'm a moral, moral god to myself, if you will. This is the ultimate kind of ice cream approach. I just want to make an observation about this first, and that is that moral relativism is not really, especially the I say relativism, is not, I've used the term moral relativism as if relativism is a bona fide, legitimate player in the moral discussion, as it were. Now, if you take ethics in college or high school or wherever you might take it, you read a book on it, you realize that these books are meant to explore different ways that people have thought about how ethics work. And so you have deontological ethics, and you've got utilitarian ethics, and you've got virtue ethics, and you've got different types, emotivism, different ways that people have explained the ethical project. What's the best way to understand this, okay? No ethics course in college will tell you how to live. They don't talk about that. They talk about people who talk about ethics. Anyway, what was the point I was going to make with that? Oh. So there is a legitimate discussion about different ethical systems, and using the phrase moral relativism gives the false impression that one of the legitimate players in the moral discussion or the discussion about morality is relativism. It is not. It's an outsider, because moral relativism is not an affirmation of morality as these others are in some sense. It is a denial of morality. It is revisionist in saying that when we talk about morality, we're talking about nothing. So talking about how you organize moral things is kind of a waste of time, because there aren't those things. They don't exist. And here we'll explain why we think they exist when they don't. And so they come up with these different things. Here's what's really going on. Morality doesn't actually exist in the objective. It's just a matter of individual opinions or whatever. Now I want you to think about this. What do we call the most consistent moral relativist, to make the point that this isn't really a bona fide, legitimate moral system? What do you call a person who has no regard for other people's idea of what's right or wrong, lives entirely by his own moral standard, marches most thoroughly and consistently to the beat of his own personal, private, moral drum? We have that's not an anarchist. It's worse. It's a sociopath. A sociopath is a person with no conscience. It's a homicide detective's worst nightmare. That's what relativism accomplishes. This is the best result. I mean, it's the hero of relativism is a sociopath. Well, that's why moral relativism has not stood in any moral tradition. And you can look at any great moral teacher, whether it's Moses or Apostle Paul or Aristotle or Plato, or, you know, right down the line, Martin Luther King, nobody held this view and was universally rejected by all. A person who is a relativist has no morality. Now, they don't like saying that. They say, I got my morality. I do what I think is right. That's my morality. Well, that's my point. Morality isn't doing whatever you think is right. Morality is trying to figure out what is right and then doing it whether you like it or not. Okay, let me give you a refutation. Now, I've given you arguments against two types of relativism. I want to spend my remaining time, which is probably about 8 minutes, and I'm sorry I'm not going to be able to take questions, but I will give you a tactic that, in principle, will help you to deal with this issue on the street, as it were. I'm going to give you now an argument against I say relativism. And I'm arguing in a particular way. I have been arguing this way all along, but let me be more precise or be focused on this. I'm arguing based on what philosophers call intuition. Now, intuition isn't a hunch, not the way I'm using the word. It's not a hunch. It's not a guess. It's not something you learn through a lot of exposure to your field or whatever, and you kind of come up with the answers quickly. What I mean is something that you know that you don't know you know. You don't know how you know it. It's just there. It's at the ground level. When I say, for example, that Socrates is, all men are mortal. Socrates is a man, therefore, all men are mortal. Socrates is a man, therefore, Socrates is mortal. Now, how did you all get that? How did you know the answer to that? Well, you think, well, some of you say, well, I learned it in philosophy. You didn't learn it in philosophy. You knew it before that, too. You just see when you gaze upon it and you understand those first two sentences that it follows. Socrates is mortal, okay? That's based on a rational intuition. It's something that's built in. And if you didn't see that, something would be wrong. In fact, if you didn't see it, I wouldn't be able to convince you of it. The only thing I could do is just go over that thing again, as I did. I wouldn't say, let me give you an argument for that. I said, no, this is it. If you either get it or you don't. We're kind of at the basement here on these issues. You understand what I'm talking about? That's intuition. Now, I think there are rational intuitions. I think there are aesthetic intuitions. I don't think beauty is in the eye of the beholder, principally, foundationally. But I also think there are moral intuitions. That is, there is a moral machine inside of us that's built in that gives us the ability to see things. And therefore, my appeal is just to that ability that you have, and that's all we're doing is reflecting on that ability. Now, I don't bear any burden of proof beyond just pointing at it in these kinds of cases. I'm just making the appeal to intuition, asking you to think about it. For example, if I said to somebody, rape is wrong, and they said, well, I don't think it's wrong, what am I going to do to try to make them understand that? I mean, where am I going to go? If they don't see it, what am I going to say? I'm not going to say, boy, you've got an interesting alternate morality. I'm going to say, get help. Because something's wrong with you if you don't understand this. So that's the motif. And what I'm going to do is look at some things in our language and discourse that are moral in nature, that depend for their meaningfulness on objective morality. It's not up there anymore. Such that if subjective morality relativism is true, then these notions are meaningless. Right? It'll become more clear to you when I get into the illustrations. In the book, we have 7 fatal flaws. I'm only going to cover 3 or 4 for the sake of time and then give you one closing tactic in dealing with this. First, if relativism is true, then there is no such thing as wrongdoing. Now, there may be things that we wouldn't do. There may be things that we wouldn't like or prefer. But we can never say that action is wrong. Because then that's an appeal to an objective moral standard that we deny exists. All we could say is that it's different from our point of view. Do you see that? Now, if that's what follows from individual ethical relativism, I say relativism, and when we reflect for a moment on certain behaviors and actions, it just seems pretty obvious that it's appropriate to call that wrong. If some things are wrong in themselves, then relativism is false. I'll tell you the illustrations I use now when I debate. I use Matthew Shepard as an example. The homosexual man who was beaten and strung up on a fence and died overnight through exposure in one of those cowboy states. If I say Wyoming and it's Montana, then the Wyoming people get mad at me. If I say Montana and it's Wyoming, then the Montana. Anyway, so it's one of those cowboy states. And regardless of what the facts are, and there's a lot of confusion about what actually took place there and what the motives of the killers were and everything else, doesn't matter. People understand that they see this as homophobic gay bashing and it was a grisly murder, and that such a thing is wrong. However, if you're a relativist, you can't say that. Not and mean that it's really wrong. There are no wrong things. But if there are some things that are wrong, then relativism is false. Second flaw. If you're a relativist, you can never, ever again complain about the problem of evil in the world. You notice how a lot of people will raise arguments against the existence of God because of the existence of evil in the world. Now, what has to exist for that argument to even go forward? There has to be what? Evil in the world. Well, evil in the world is just another way of saying that there are people who do things that are actually, really, objectively wrong, resulting in the evil that people are complaining about. But if relativism is true, there are no such things, are there? There are no objective wrongs. There can be no real evil in the world. There is just personal opinions about things, and therefore the objection against the existence of God based on the apparent existence of evil really amounts to this. I can't believe in God anymore. Why not? Brussels sprouts. Brussels sprouts. What's up with Brussels sprouts? Do you ever taste those things? They're disgusting. Which, I agree, they are, but some people do like them after all. And the guy says, well, I can't believe in a God who would make something so distasteful to me. But isn't that what the objection to the problem of evil is on a relativist take of things? Because maybe those things aren't really evil. Maybe people like doing that and they're good for them. You just don't like it. So why should God cease to exist? Because there are things that you don't like. I mean, this reduces the objection to silliness. But this objection against the existence of God, which needs to be answered by Christians, and we've got some tapes and stuff to deal with, and Doug Guyvett has written a wonderful book dealing with it, in fact, God and the Problem of Evil, I think. In any event, these are things that have to be addressed. And as Christians, but notice that, and we can, but notice that in order for there to be a problem at all, there has to be evil in the world. Relativism has to be false. So every time people complain about evil in the world, they are refuting relativism from their own lips. Okay. One last flaw. There's a bunch more, but you can see these are kin to each other. The last one is, if relativism is true, then there can be no tolerance. There could be no tolerance. Almost done there, Pop. That's my boss. He's about to pull my chain. Tolerance is a moral good that presents a moral obligation on all people to act a certain way. But if relativism is true, there is no moral obligation of tolerance because there are no moral obligations at all. Even tolerance gets eaten up in the moral twilight of relativism. Now, nobody believes this. They talk a good game, but they don't actually believe. They can talk this way, they can't live this way. They can stand in line with you in the bank talking about relativism, then somebody cuts in line in front of them, and they say, hey, buddy, get in the back of the line. You shouldn't do that. And then they don't say, and by the way, that's just my own personal moral point of view. It has nothing to do with you. Just ignore me. Because they think the person did something wrong. And so it is this that you're looking for all people who claim to be relativists. They can't get away with it because, in fact, they're made in the image of God. And the morality is built in with them. And they are going to say two things at the same time. There are no moral rules. Here's one. There are no moral rules. Here's one. And you're listening for the here's one. And you're going to request of them to make sense of this. Best illustration, at the same chiropractor's office, another person taking care of me, got in a conversation about morality. His name was Gil. He got upset because I thought homosexuality was wrong. He said, you Christians are nice people, but pretty soon you start getting judgmental. Now you see already there's a problem here. He didn't see it. So I'm going to help him see it. You know, it's like, kitty, 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 come on. I said, Gil, what's wrong with that? He says, well, it's wrong to judge. And so I said, well, Gil, then why are you judging me right now? Did you guys catch that?
Yeah.
Okay. There are no moral rules. Here's one. Same thing. So he drops back, and he's rubbing his chin because he never heard that before. He's trying to regroup. He's trying to get started. All right, you got me there. I guess I was judging. I guess it's okay to judge. But, so he said. He said, but you can't push your morality on me. Once you push your morality on somebody else, you cross the line. Now, he thought he'd improved his lot. He just went out of the frying pan, right into the fire, right? Because I had another question for him. Notice how I'm using the questions. The question was, Gil, is that your morality? That you shouldn't push morality on others? Is that your moral point of view? He said, yes. See, he didn't even get it. He didn't see what was coming. He said, oh, yeah, uh-huh. I said, then why are you, what? Pushing it on me right now. Oh, yeah, gosh. Finally, you know, he made a couple false starts. He couldn't get started, and he got real upset. And he said, oh, now you're not. He said, it's not fair. So what do you mean? He said, I can't find a way to say it in which it sounds right. He thought I was playing a word trick on him. I said, Gil, it's not a trick. You're doing the very thing you're telling me not to do. It's self-refuting, you know. And sometimes I get in conversations with people and they say, well, now you got me all confused. I tell him, I said, no, you were confused when you started. You just now figured that out. That gives you an idea of how this project works. Now, the book Relativism has more details on it, the notes in the back, some of the things that you missed maybe in taking notes that are available there. There are also, the books are gone now, but there are also training tapes on relativism, and all the tapes, the CDs, in this case, have the PDF file where you can print out the notes on. This has two talks, the one I just gave in more robust form, and Monkey Morality, Can Evolution Explain Ethics? It can't. That's the second talk. And then this blue one is a DVD training series. It's got a leader's workbook in it. Dr. Beckwith and I, who authored the book, are interviewed by Summit Ministries. They take cameras on campus, and there's an interaction there. And we go over the material in four sessions. So it's a great group training thing. Hope to see you at one of the other sessions. Thank you for your time.